Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and that, believe it or not, was Leonard Cohen with his song Mountain of Debt, which is our way of introducing our next guest, Dr. James Kwok, a professor of at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He's the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the popular economics blog BaselineScenario.com. And he and Simon Johnson are also co-authors of the bestseller 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Crisis. And his new book just out is White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kwok.
Thanks very much for having me back.
And the book that you and Simon Johnson have done, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters, is an attempt to expose the myths surrounding deficits and debts. And it also provides a prescription of what needs to be done to fix our economy. But how do you fix the political gridlock? How do you get the gridlock to end and an adult discussion to begin?
Yeah, well, you had to start me off with the toughest question, didn't you? that is the most important question. I think that there is no easy answer. I think that the best answer I can give you, and perhaps one of the reasons why we most important reasons why we wrote the book, is that I do believe that at the end of the day, the political, in a sense, the politicians we have are the ones we deserve. So the politicians are elected by the ordinary people, by people like you and me. And if politicians say nonsensical things, it's because we allow them to get away with it. And I think that one problem with discussions of deficits and the national debt has been that this is a complicated and oftentimes a seemingly boring topic, and people don't understand quite how it affects them in their daily lives. So just to give you one example about this, if you poll people, a lot of people think the national debt is a problem. It generally comes in number two to jobs. So jobs and unemployment is number one, then deficits and the debt are number two. And then if you ask people what we should do, they say we should cut spending. And then if you ask them, well, should we cut Medicare? They say no. Should we cut Social Security? They say no. Should we cut Medicaid? They say no. Should we cut national defense? They say no. And this is because it's a combination of people not understanding what's in the federal budget, for which you can't blame people. It's a pretty technical topic. And it's also a combination of that and the fact that our politicians do not talk straight with the American people. So this is a very long way of saying that if people become better educated and take an interest in these ideas, like a lot of people did in 2009, 2010, about our financial system, then we have a better chance of having a serious policy debate. Now, one thing I've not mentioned in all of this is the huge and growing influence of money in politics, which makes this more difficult. But that's essentially the only way I think we can have a serious discussion.
But it seems to me that people in their minds, and I'm pretty sure that they've also been encouraged to think this way, equate the national debt to their own personal finances. Isn't that one of the problems?
I think that is a very common way of thinking about the national debt, and it has the benefit of being clear and immediate and concrete. And as many economists will tell you, it's in many ways it's fundamentally wrong. So I think the two most important ways it's wrong: one, we saw during the past few years, which is that during a recession, for an ordinary family, when your income goes down, you generally need to cut spending, to try to make ends meet, and that's generally a good thing, because running up debt in many cases is not a good thing to do. With the federal government in a recession, I think a majority of economists, I wouldn't say all of them, but a majority think that the government should do the opposite. It should borrow money, it should spend money in order to keep the economy going. So that's one instance where the comparison to the family budget doesn't work. The other instance, which is perhaps more important for our book, is that the dynamics of when a country is no longer able to borrow money are very different from the dynamics of when a family is not able to borrow money. So families can go bankrupt if they can't meet their debts. The United States government is a much more complicated thing. I think we saw, last summer, during the debt ceiling crisis, or slightly just after the debt ceiling crisis, S&P downgraded the Treasury Department, and interest rates fell, which means that more and more people wanted to buy U.S. government debt. Now, one of the things we say in our book is that this probably can't last forever, but certainly in the environment we're in right now, the amount of debt that the United States is taking on has not yet shown up in a reduction in our ability to borrow. But as I said, we think that this is not something we should count on for the next 30 or 50 years.
Well, a lot of it is caught up, I think, particularly you mentioned the threatened to shut down the government. It happened a couple of times, as a matter of fact, over the debt ceiling. And a lot of that is driven by the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, and to some extent the Ron Paul people as well. And they have the advantage of living in a very theoretical world. In many ways, I would wish that there could be an alternative universe to show what a country like the United States would be like without a government.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Although I would say, actually, we don't necessarily need an alternative universe. I mean, there are actually countries that have very low taxes and very low government services. A lot of them are in Africa, and a lot of them are very, very poor because you don't have government services, so the only people who can afford private security are the very rich. You don't have roads, so people can't bring their products to market. You don't have a stable currency, so business essentially breaks down. And that is the extreme. I mean, that is what happens when you don't have government services. Now, just getting back to the Tea Party for a second, I do think that the Tea Party is a multifaceted phenomenon, let's say. And I do think that on the one hand, you have a lot of people who very genuinely believe that we should have much smaller government and much lower taxes. And I would say that is actually a kind of a coherent position. I think at the same time, you have some other people, especially among the political operatives and the funders, who are much more cynical. And essentially, their ploy is to cut taxes at any possible opportunity, and with the full realization that this is never going to be matched by lower spending. And we saw that during the Bush administration. You know, we just saw that with Paul Ryan's budget. He wants to slash everything, but he wants to increase defense spending.
And cut $150,000 tax on all the wealthy. So, James Kwok, again, professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He's a co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the popular economics blog BaselineScenario.com. And he and Simon Johnson are co-authors of the bestseller 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and The Next Financial Crisis. And they have this new book, which we're talking about now, just out, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. And the book points out, of course, that a lot of people, 44% of Social Security recipients say they do not use a government program, as do 40% of Medicare recipients and 43% of unemployment benefit recipients. So you have this sort of immaculate economy here that has invisible socialism, if you will, and it leads me to ask. I mean, obviously, it's an example of enormous ignorance and economic illiteracy. But it also leads me to the main question, which I wish the debate was framed around, instead of most of what we've been talking about, which I don't think are particularly insightful or helpful debates about the debt and the deficits. One would hope the American taxpayer was thinking about, and after all, Americans are pretty pragmatic and practical people, you would think that people in this country would be really focused upon what they get for their tax money, what government services they get, and the quality of the government services they get, as opposed to their obsession with the fact that they're overtaxed, which they are not by international standards.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, to take the last point you said, if you look at advanced industrial countries in the world, we are one of the lowest taxed advanced industrial countries in the world. If you look at federal and state and local taxes put together, lower than every country in Western Europe. There are a couple Asian countries that pay lower taxes than we do. Going back to your point, I think, you know, Americans' relationship with the government is actually quite complicated, but I think a lot of politicians have simplified it beyond recognition. So to say what I mean by that, you're absolutely right. I mean, we pay taxes, we get services. And these days, most of what the government spends comes directly back to people. So two-thirds of all government spending is in the category that's called payments for individuals. So that includes Social Security checks. It includes Medicare reimbursements. It includes Medicaid reimbursements. Includes salaries and so on. So the idea that... But instead, I think that a lot of people have the image that most of their taxes go to faceless government bureaucrats who do things they don't understand. And what we hear about is specific examples when things go wrong, like Solyndra. Solyndra got an enormous amount of press, right? So, because there was a government loan that went bad, and people think essentially the government is this corrupt, incompetent thing. Now, the federal government is not, you know, all branches of it are not the most efficient organization in the world, I will grant you that. But when it comes down to the question of what are you getting, or where are your taxes going, you know, the EPA, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, those are all rounding errors. The real money is in Social Security first, Medicare second, and then National Defense is third. And I'm sorry, actually, National Defense is before Medicare now, but Medicare is growing faster. But I think what's happened is that people, on the one hand, they know, if you ask them about it, they like Medicare. They say they want to keep Medicare the way it is. But at the same time, they have a very abstract notion of the government as this wasteful, corrupt thing that gobbles up their taxes and doesn't give them anything back. And that image, I think, has been fostered, you know, for decades, especially particularly by conservatives by anti-government, anti-tax conservatives, who have played up this image of the wasteful government, and moved the spotlight away from the programs that people do like. But last thing I wanted to say on that point is, you know, when push comes to shove, the Ryan budget essentially drastically reshapes Medicare and then cuts, you know, most spending on government services down to virtually nothing over the next few decades. And the real question is this actually possible? Because, you know, Republicans have been talking about cutting back these social insurance programs for decades. And when push comes to shove, I'm not sure, even if they win the White House, they win the Senate, they get 60 votes in the Senate. Well, they're not going to get 60 votes, but even if they win the White House and they get the Senate this fall, it'll be a very interesting question to see if they follow through on these plans, because I'm not sure they have the stomach essentially to roll back the government to the 1920s, and I'm not sure the American people will stand for it.
Well, it's not as if they haven't tried. I mean, George W. Bush he got reelected. He said, "I got political capital," and he spent all of his political capital on tilting at windmills, trying to privatize Social Security. And imagine what would have happened to Social Security if it had been privatized, and what happened in 2008 on Wall Street.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that's a very good point you bring up. It's interesting to note that Social Security is the one thing that the current crop of Republicans will not touch. So Paul Ryan, I know in last year's budget, I believe in this year's budget, essentially does not touch Social Security. And I think that's partly because of the experience of George W. Bush. And so now the heavy guns are aimed at Medicare and essentially, you know, on the premise, basically on the premise that we cannot afford to sustain Medicare for the next few decades. So,
well, just in closing, sorry, I know we've only got a couple of minutes left here.
Sure.
I just wanted to get an understanding of a lot of young Americans who believe that they'll never see their Social Security and they don't have to pay in for something they don't think they're going to get. This belief system is encouraged by Ron Paul, and they are flocking to libertarianism. And it seems to me that is a demonstrable example of the failure of the Democrats to communicate economic reality.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that part of it is that the, you know, the libertarian slogans are easier to communicate than what I would say is, you know, the principled defense of social insurance programs. You know, the way I would try to put it, and I know I'm not a political consultant or a messaging expert, but the way I would put it is that Social Security and Medicare, you know, are often framed as transfers from the young to the rich. From the young to the elderly. That's not how I look at them. I look at them as a way for all of us to share risks across society. Because if you think about it, when you're 21 years old, you're entering the workforce. You don't know how long you're going to work. You don't know how much money you're going to make. You don't know how healthy you're going to be. You don't know how much healthcare inflation there's going to be. You don't know if you're going to be disabled, if your parents are going to end up in a nursing home, and so on. There are all these things you can't predict. And I think that the only institution that can protect you from these risks in the long term or help you manage these risks is the federal government, because no private insurance company can insure you against something that's going to happen 50 years from now.
Well,
and I think that.
I'm afraid to say we've run out of time, Dr. James Quirk. But I thank you for joining us and hope we can have a follow-up conversation.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. James Quirk, who's professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law and a fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He is a co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the popular economics blog BaselineScenario.com. His latest book is White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Princeton historian Sean Wilentz, who's written about Ronald Reagan. And yesterday, the president said Ronald Reagan would not survive in today's Republican primary. We talked about how far the party had moved to the right and how amazing it is that this largely religious evangelical party has accepted, apparently, perhaps grudgingly, the Mormon Mitt Romney. Then the question becomes, who does this dull guy get as his VP? Obviously, you can't get somebody that's more interesting than you are, that you'll be upstaged. And I suggest it's going to be pretty hard to find somebody that's duller than Romney. One of the suggestions made by Van Jones, of all people, was Condoleezza Rice, which we looked into. Then I spoke with Tom Ferguson about the Ryan budget. And, of course, it is an obscenity. And it is more social Darwinism, and $150,000 for tax break for the already super rich had all the tax breaks in the world. And we talked about what that would buy in terms of social programs and whether the president is going to run as a populist, because there's always been this disconnect between the Democratic base and the Democratic politicians and their funders. Little wonder people feel they're sold out, because the Obamas and the Clintons have to respond to the people who give them money and not to the people who vote for them, and thus the disconnect. So he thinks that it's going to be a tough race in spite of what a terrible candidate Romney is. And then finally, I spoke with James Quirk, the co-author with Simon Johnson of the new book, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. And we discussed all of the myths surrounding deficits and debts and why it is that the American taxpayer is distracted by this lie that they pay too much taxes and don't really concentrate on not how much taxes you pay, but what you get back for your taxes in terms of government services. The rest of the civilized world understands that, but we have yet to figure that one out. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.